rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
It's lunchtime on the shingle at Dungeness in Kent, and the fourth and fifth boats are now being escorted in by the RNLI.
Back on the 24th of November 2021, I was down on the coast of Kent on Dungeness. I was there to report on small boats arriving, and it was an extremely cold day. The waves were pretty noisy, and the weather was never, I don't think it ever got above 3, 4, 5 degrees. And on that day, we saw about 600 people arrive in small boats onto Dungeness Peninsula alone.
Yeah. It's a very flat, bleak stretch of coastline, and the people who've arrived stand wrapped in blankets or shawls while their possessions are taken from them and processed in plastic bags.
It was a very desperate situation, with a lot of people arriving from boats that were falling apart in rescuers' hands, huddling on the beach, waiting for someone to take them to a processing centre. And what we didn't really know at that point was that out at sea, one of those boats was in trouble. At about halfway through the afternoon, we found out that a boat had sunk. We thought maybe there'd been two or three people dead, was the initial belief. But then that evening, we found out that it was the worst disaster so far to strike the small boats crossings. The final toll would be 27 people. One of those people was a young man called Zanyar Mustafa Mina Nebi. And he was coming here with his brother to try and find a better life. But ultimately, he never got the life he wanted in the UK.
In the 18 months since Zanyar Mustafa Mina Nebi drowned on that boat, Emma Yeomans and a team of reporters have been looking into the murky world of people smuggling. Emma's been investigating how untraceable middlemen facilitate payments between the smugglers and the smuggled, and how an ancient banking system allows this whole industry to flourish in the shadows. All while here in Britain, the question of how to stop small boats and channel crossings continues to dominate politics.
We will pass new laws to stop small boats, making sure that if you come to this country illegally, you are detained and swiftly removed.
Even if this bill succeeded in temporarily stopping the boats, and I don't think it will, it won't stop conflict or climate migration.
While the debate in Parliament continues, the boat crossings do too. But how are the smugglers able to move people across the channel? How is it all funded? You're listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Manveen Rana. Today, the underground bankers funding people smugglers.
I'm Emma Yeomans. I'm one of the news reporters at The Times. I cover a really wide range of topics, but I take a particular interest in migration issues.
And that day, 18 months ago, when you're standing there in the cold by the sea, watching hundreds of people make it to Britain, but also knowing that disaster is unfolding out at sea, how did that lead to the investigation you've been doing?
So after that day, I really wanted to find out more about the smugglers and who's putting people in these rickety boats. We were also really interested in how people on the move manage their money for these journeys, knowing that, as I'd been told that day on the beach, it's extremely expensive to cross the English Channel. We wanted to find out, how do people avoid being scammed and robbed? How do they fund their journeys? How do they arrange payment to these smugglers? And that's how we came to the Hawala system.
Emma, you find out that the smuggling is being enabled by this Hawala system. Just tell us, what exactly is it and how does it work?
It's very, very ancient. You can date it all the way back to the Silk Road, and it's most popular in the Middle East and in diaspora communities. It basically works through balance debt. So you'll have a broker, a Hawalada in one country, who'll have a counterpart in another country. They'll know one another. And if I deposit maybe £50 at a Hawala broker in Britain with the aim of sending it to my friend in France, I then ring up my friend, we agree on a little password, I tell my friend where to collect the money. Separately, the broker in England rings up his friend in France, tells them the password, says Emma's friend is going to come and collect £50, and they go ahead and collect the money. And what's striking there is that nothing has actually been transferred. The £50 in cash is still in Britain with my broker.
So if the money hasn't left, how does your friend in France get £50?
It's really simple. The Hawala broker in France and England, they just owe each other money. So in this case, the broker in France will take some of their store of money and give it out to my friend. And the British broker will now owe £50 to the French guy. They'll just keep a note of who owes what to whom. And then later on, if someone in France wants to send money in the opposite direction, the two debts balance each other out.
I see. So the money never really leaves. Who uses this system? Why is it so popular?
It's really useful for communities where access to banking is patchy. In some parts of the world, for example, where a lot of people do live without any access to formal banking, Hawala still works because there's no need to have a bank account. It's also useful for sending money internationally with different exchange fees. Hawaladas will often take a small proportion as a fee, but it's very variable and often more affordable. So it's a very clever way of moving money around without really leaving any trace, because there's no electronic record of a transfer. It can be as simple as a little token, a receipt, or even just a spoken password. By virtue of being untraceable, it does have a degree of popularity with criminals. In the past, it's been known to be used by terrorist financing. And when you talk to law enforcement about it, they are aware, and they will bring up that it's used for money laundering, for paying for smuggling journeys, so many applications. But they were also very keen to stress to us that the vast majority is very legitimate, normally people sending money to their families.
I mean, given that, I take it is legal, even though it's used by terrorists and criminals.
That is a very good question, and the answer depends where you are in the world. In Britain, it is legal if you register as an authorised money transfer provider. And that means you have to keep a register of who your customers are, you have to do your due diligence, you have to do some anti-money laundering work. Not all Hawaladas will bother registering, and those who don't are acting illegally. They could be charged under money laundering laws.
Right.
In other countries, for example, in Turkey, it's entirely illegal. So it really varies hugely around the world.
And Emma, Earlier, you were telling us about the story of Zanyar, who was trying to come to Britain when he drowned along the way. Tell us a little bit more about him. Tell us a bit about his background and his story.
Mustafa. Nebi.
We spoke with Zanyar's father, Mustafa. This was one of my colleagues on the investigation, a reporter called Andres from Turkey.
So he was born in January 12th, 2001.
So Zanyar comes from a small village in Iraq, a village where migration to Europe and particularly to the UK is quite common. His older brother, Halbir, went with him to Turkey when he left and on to the UK. But they went through different routes and at slightly different times. He never graduated high school because he just felt very despondent about his life in Iraq. That was what motivated him in the end to leave.
He decided, you know, like studying is useless because he, you know, as we know in our country, there are so many that who graduates and can't find jobs.
His father told us a lot about why so many people in their area leave. Before ISIS, it was very good. He liked it there. They were very happy. They were quite wealthy. He had lands, he had a car, he had a house, all of which was sold in the end to both to fund the family and also to fund his two children leaving. They describe a pretty dire economic situation after the conflict with ISIS.
So it affected everything, like the pricing of houses, the pricing of land, and the salaries of people. We used to get salaries like once every 3 months.
So the family were really struggling financially. They were very frightened of future conflict. They were very frightened of the political situation in the Kurdistan region. And for his sons, it felt like there was very little hope for their home.
Given the state of Iraq at the time, Zanyar was desperate to leave and was desperate to come to the UK. He was going to have to do that via people smugglers. How did he go about doing that?
So the family started by sending both their sons to Turkey. Mustafa says, "I told my son to go to Turkey and find a good smuggler who will guarantee your life." This is quite a common sentiment. It's so important to find someone you can trust. And that's really where the Havala brokers come in. In a lot of cases, it's actually quite a sophisticated system where these brokers will act almost like a travel agency. Some of them even call themselves travel agencies, actually, where they will have built up relationships with smugglers who they think they can trust. And they will almost act as middlemen, putting would-be clients for the smugglers in touch with the smugglers themselves. That's how Mustafa and his sons did it in the end. In their town, Sangasar, they found someone there who would support the financial side, who would handle all of the payments to the smugglers. And this acted as an insurance for them as a family, because they may not like or trust the smuggler that much, but they know that the smuggler will not get his money. The broker will not pass that cash on or make that transfer until Zanyar had reached his destinations.
That's so interesting. And how does that work out? So this insurance policy, this sense that the smuggler doesn't get paid until Zanyar gets to each place, does he get paid per stage or does it all happen at the end?
In Zanyar's case, it was stage by stage. That's because he worked with a number of different smugglers for different points on his journey. That's quite common, actually. All Zanyar would have to do was text his father, normally with a little WhatsApp location pin, which again, we found was quite common, and say, I made it, I'm safely here.
So this is the father going and paying, making these payments to the Havala brokers in the middle, and then they only get passed on when his son texts him to say, I'm here.
Exactly.
And presumably the Havalada, the broker, gets a cut.
Yes. We don't know exactly how much that is. We encountered it was anything between 4 and 15%.
So if I'm a smuggler in France and I've managed to get Zanyar to France safely, at that point, Mustafa and Zanyar's Havalada would pay me the cash for that leg of the journey. This whole system basically ensures that the smugglers do get paid. when they've done their job. I mean, looking at that from afar, you know, it does look like this entire system is entirely based on trust. I mean, how do they make sure that that trust is protected?
It was one of the first things that struck us as a group of reporters working on this was, how does that get maintained? How does a Havalida build that trust in the first place? The answer in a lot of cases is that they're a well-known community figure. So in Mustafa and Zanya's case, the broker they used was someone senior and well-known in their local community. Everyone would have known him. They would have all used him, or the majority of people would have worked with him at least once or twice with other financial affairs. So to screw over one person is to jeopardize his entire business as a Havala broker. And that's a running theme.
So he's saying over here, it's especially in this area, it's a tribal thing, and he won't ruin his reputation. They won't betray someone else.
They only operate on trust, and the moment that's broken, they lose all of their business. So it's a fairly short-term gain if you were to break someone's trust on that. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen, though. We did hear about cases in which Havaladas had taken the money and run, or not transferred it properly, but it was exceptionally uncommon, and it was very rare to find anyone who didn't trust them.
That's remarkable, because it's a lot of trust, and it is an insurance policy for the family to make sure that the smugglers do what they're promising they will. In terms of legality, I mean, I know we've said that this system of payments is legal in this country. Is what they're doing there, though, using it to pay smugglers, is that entirely legal?
No, it isn't. It isn't. And the NCA, the National Crime Agency, are and have been investigating specific Havala brokers for this. It's illegal under two grounds. Firstly, the brokers who do this within the UK, which are rare, most of them are not based in the UK, but there are some. The brokers who do it are tending not to be registered, which means that their whole business model is legally just money laundering. They also face charges in some cases for facilitating illegal immigration. The NCA described it quite bluntly as a criminal escrow. They do see it very, very directly as making smuggling possible. But also, I think in that there's a recognition that it makes it safer for migrants, and that this is quite an important insurance system for migrants.
Coming up, should the authorities be cracking down on Havala?
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times Radio app.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Using Havala to pay for his journey, Zanya made his way across Europe from Kurdistan in northern Iraq.
23rd, 9th, he was in Turkey.
So he left his home in September 2021, flew to Turkey. They went to Turkey with a visa. From there, he went on to Bulgaria, but was caught and sent back. It's quite common along that border. And at that point, a smuggler took him to Italy. This was arranged through his father. It took him to Italy by boat. He then made his way up again with the help of smugglers to Calais by plane and train. And that's when he settled with some friends into the camp.
What happens when he gets to France?
In France, he spent around 39 days in the camps in Calais, which is quite a long time to be somewhere that cold and that lacking in resources. And at this point, we understand that there was a fair bit of pressure on him. And this is very common, actually, that the smugglers know they're not going to get paid until their charge reaches the other side of the channel. So they do put more pressure on people to get into the boats, even if the sea looks bad or the boat looks really, really rickety that day.
He was unlucky, you know. He tried to go with a couple of groups. The trip was getting cancelled, or, you know, it was a lot of things. That's why he was unlucky. It didn't happen.
He made multiple attempts to cross. We don't know exactly why they failed, but we do know that they were made. His father said,
I put 2,500 in exchange office so he can cross, but it didn't happen. So obviously he got the money back.
He got the money back because they didn't make the crossing.
Then, on the 24th of November, 2021, Zanya, along with 29 others, boarded an inflatable dinghy and set off across the channel.
It's 5 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive. The headlines: several migrants have drowned while trying to cross the channel in an inflatable dinghy. Emma Yeomans is covering the story for the Times.
Having seen some of these boats come ashore today...
And for Mustafa, like every other attempt, he will have been waiting for the text from his son to say, "I've made it," or "it got cancelled today." At what point did he realise that something had gone horribly wrong?
He was quite open with us about this part of his story. He was furious, Mustafa was, with the smuggler who was also a friend of his, or a friend of his cousin, so they had that relationship, and he was very upset that it took so long for the smuggler to admit that anything went wrong.
He was in contact, and he was asking, "There's an incident happened. Is it the one that my son is on?" And he was saying, "No, it's not. It's a different one. I have no information." So he was really careless about doing his job.
Zanyar didn't have a phone with him at this point. He was relying on his friends' phones. So Mustafa had no way of contacting him to check that all was okay. But it was, I think, 10 to 12 hours after the boat went down that the smuggler finally got in touch with Mustafa and said, "Something's gone wrong."
He really kept it quiet, and they were not dead until maybe after 10 to 12 hours. They were in the water till they, froze to death. Yeah, if he did something, called us, warned some other people, maybe we would have done something, but it's his fault. The fault is on him.
On the smuggler.
Oh, the smuggler, yeah, the Bashdar guy.
Emma, a horrifying case like that really does bring home, you know, the dangers of smuggling and why it's such a concern for the authorities. At the moment, Havala itself as a system is legal in Britain. There are question marks about how it's being used for within this context of smuggling. Are there any moves by the authorities here to criminalise any part of it or to try and crack down on the people who are involved?
Because it is possible to do it legally and regulated in this country, I think it's very unlikely we'll see any moves to change that status. It's just too useful. Even law enforcement, while they were telling us about cases they were aware of where it was being used for migration, where it was facilitating smuggling, they were also stressing to us that the vast majority of transfers are perfectly legitimate. Normally, people trying to send a bit of money home to help their families. So I think it's highly unlikely we'd see a change to its legal status in the UK. That said, there are countries where it's more or less regulated, and I'm sure law enforcement would welcome a more coherent global regulation of it so that there are registers of transfers, we do know who's using it, and that a transfer, once it's made, isn't essentially invisible.
And Emma, you've been looking at migration for months now. It's a subject you're covering in real depth. It is also one of the big subjects on the British political agenda.
An answer. Because the reality is, Mr. Deputy Speaker, those arguing for open borders via unlimited, safe and legal routes are, of course, they are, of course, entitled to do so. But they should do so honestly. They shouldn't try to deceive the public, Mr. Deputy Speaker, by dressing up what is an extreme political argument in the fake garb of humanitarianism. Nor, Mr. Deputy Speaker, nor should they pretend that the UK doesn't have global safe and legal routes. In recent years, our country-specific routes...
Policymakers are constantly trying to work out what to do about small boats making the crossings. From what you've seen, would this be an effective arena for policymaking? Is this something that they should be looking at, the money transfers and the way they enable smugglers to do what they do?
I don't think so. Transfers like this are not a cause of migration to the UK. They're an effect. They have grown out of, as a system, it has grown out of the lack of safe routes, the extreme risks that migrants face on their journey from violence, from being swindled. All of that comes really down to the fact that people want to come here and they don't know how. And then a sort of ecosystem builds up to try and make that a bit safer. I think legislating against Havala and legislating against its use here would not change a single journey other than making those journeys unsafe. People would just come and they would have no way to know whether they're throwing all their money away or whether they're going to make it across the channel.
And does this very discrete system of payments, the way you can't really trace it, does it explain just the complexity of the issue? When we talk about trying to stop the boats, there is this entire network behind it, which makes it very hard to do.
It really does. And the sheer variety, even within this specific part of the system. Zanya and a lot of young men like him work closely with one broker back in their hometown who works with the smugglers. But that's not the case for everyone. We even spoke to one guy who deposited the money for his crossing simply at a corner shop in Paris. How do you crack down on a system that large and that informal? It's a big grey area of financing, and I don't know how, without accurate records of transactions, I don't know how it can really be policed more than it is.
And going back to the case of Zanya, does his father, does Mustafa now blame the man they trusted with their money, the broker, the Havaladar? Does he blame him for what happened to his son?
No, he doesn't. He still trusts and likes and knows in person the broker. He blames the smuggler. He was furious with the smuggler, still is, and took the smuggler's details to the police, handed him in, has done everything he can to get justice for his son from the smugglers, but he will not ever, as far as we know, betray the broker.
There's that much respect for the broker and for the system.
He believes firmly that the broker would not ruin his reputation by doing anything to hurt a migrant. That's one of the reasons why ultimately the broker refunded the family for Zanya's journey. He told us quite firmly, the smugglers trust the money exchange, but we trust it too.
Zanya Mustafa Mina Nabi was 20 years old. His body was found at sea. You've been listening to Stories of Our Times, a podcast brought to you thanks to the subscribers of The Times and The Sunday Times, with me, Manveen Rana, and my guest, news reporter at The Times, Emma Yeomans. You can find all of Emma's work, including the full piece about this investigation, online at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription. The producer today was Sam Chantarasak, with production assistance from Max Kendix. The executive producer is Kate Ford, and sound design was by David Crackles. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. Thank you.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.